Welcome to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. Michael W. Dean of the Freedom Fiends cooks up a very special blend of liberty, guns, sex, rock and roll, drugs, and thriving in spite of the state in an increasingly worrying world. All with a rotating cast of nifty guests who are also up in the middle of the night.
Speaking with Scott on the Mumbles. How you doing here, Scott?
I'm all right. How's it going, man?
I'm good. It's snowing here in Casper, Wyoming. How's it in Austin, Texas?
It's like 72.
Fuck you. Oh, by the way, it's okay to cuss on this particular show.
Okay, good.
Good. If, you know, sometimes it's not. But this is Michael W. Dean on the Anarchy Gumbo. On the Gumbo today, we have Scott Horton from Anti-War Radio. How you doing, Scott?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me here.
Thanks for being had. So, can I ask how old you are? And I'll explain why.
I'm 35.
And I'm 47. The reason I ask that is I want to talk a bit about historical context of various wars and, you know, like watching them on TV and reaction to them. Like my, I was anti-war before I was, you know, anything else that defined myself. Like I was anti-war at like age 5, watching the Vietnam War on TV in 1969 and just going, this is horrible. Mm-hmm. This is not what they teach us in kindergarten, you know, and it just didn't make sense to me. So what was your journey to being anti-war and to liberty, which is related anyway?
Well, let's see. I don't know. I really don't know. It's, you know, a lot of little things, I guess. When I very first learned about Vietnam, you know, I was a young kid in the 80s, so... When I very first learned about Vietnam, I only heard it from a negative point of view, from my parents and my friends' parents, that kind of thing. Not that they taught us all about it, really, but it was pretty clear that they were all disgusted that the whole thing had happened and that their friends had had to die in it and that kind of thing. And then, you know, it was the Cold War and all that, so me and my friends, you know, we're like 10 in 86, right? So we loved Red Dawn and all the kind of Cold War stuff, and we would play guns in the woods all the time and divide it up, AKs and M16s and that kind of thing. We're boys, you know? And then when the first Gulf War came, I guess I was about 14, and man, the consensus was just everywhere that, you know, just basically telling me that my first priority was right, which is I just want to see some explosions and, you know, some jet fighter planes going really fast and doing fun stuff and whatever, just like everybody else. And then I guess what really got me on the first Gulf War was George Carlin in 1992 jamming in New York, where he just came out and said, man, if you believe in that war, you're so stupid. And that's, of course, the very best George Carlin of all. And that's what he thought, too, that jam in New York was his, you know, shining, you know, quintessential thing or whatever. That was the one that got me. And I was about 14. And it's a really great one, actually, Jam in New York, because at the beginning, it's all about the evil, bloodthirsty Republicans. And at the end, it's all about Earth Day and plastic bags and all this do-gooder liberal stuff. And so it was Carlin telling 14-year-old me that, like, here's your permission slip. You don't have to choose between the, you know, aging hippie liberal douche, as South Park called him, and, you know, Rush Limbaugh clone walking around kind of thing. So that was, you know, really good for me at the time, that I never became a liberal or a conservative. I never had to, because Carlin had told me that I didn't have to. I could just be a Carlinian, you know.
I love him.
And so then I learned all about, in high school, I learned all about the National Endowment for Democracy and the death squads in South America and the Reaganites selling cocaine. Oliver North, Dope Pusher, was this pamphlet that was going around. And, like, basically all sort of left-wing conspiracy stuff, Covert Action Quarterly and all that kind of thing. That would have been, like, in the mid-90s. And so by the time I was thoroughly versed in the Reaganites in South America and, you know, the military-industrial complex and all that, I think the first book I read was Andrew Coburn's wife, Leslie Coburn, wrote this book, Out of Control, about Iran-Contra and how these were just like the special forces guys who were all friends left over from Vietnam, and they just wanted to go cut some throats and make some money. And, you know, it's just madness to, you know, the inside the Reagan administration secret wars. That was a hell of an introduction. So I guess that's, you know, along the lines of, oh, and also Star Wars. From the time I was 3 years old, I was absolutely obsessed with Star Wars. And, of course, that's the story of the Free Republic that becomes the unlimited tyranny due to the people falling for it. And, you know, they don't get taken over and defeated by the Empire. The Republic becomes the Empire and destroys itself. That kind of thing is the story of Star Wars. So I learned that lesson well at a very young age, too.
Cool. Can you back off your mic about 2 inches? I can't control the different volumes in here and your clipping on your end.
That's I'm sorry,
that's
man.
When,
am I?
That's all right. Because when we did the sound check, you were just you were just talking, and then you got excited. That's
yeah, that'll happen.
You know, it's kind of like, do you play music in a band?
No, I don't. I have no musical talent whatsoever.
Well, you know, when you do a sound check with a band in an empty room, and then it fills up with people, it's totally different. It's kind of like that, and the band gets excited and turns up to 11. So yeah. I like George Carlin a lot, man. It seems like some of the best comedians have a kind of libertarian bent. You know, there's Doug Stanhope and who's the other guy?
Bill Hicks.
Bill Hicks and the other guy that Doug Stanhope does something down in Texas with the guy from News Radio, the guy from, you know who I'm talking about?
No.
Joe Rogan.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that guy seems like a libertarian.
Yeah.
Ron Paul fan.
Yeah, very much. Yeah, I saw him on The Tonight Show, and he was sitting next to Ron Paul, and he said, Ron Paul, I love you. You ever seen my show, Fear Factor? And Ron Paul said, no. And he said, I'm part of the problem. You're the solution.
That's funny. That's pretty much true. Well, I don't know if Ron Paul is the solution to what's wrong with Joe Rogan's show, but still, close enough.
Yeah, so... That was your journey to liberty and your journey to anti-war. Are they one and the same to you?
Well, yeah, because the whole left-wing thing wasn't working on me. I was learning left-wing revisionist history, but I wasn't, you know, coming at it. Well, always coming at it from an underdog point of view. So leftist in that sense, never, you know, I wasn't raised like wearing a suit and going to church and thinking I was going to grow up to be a capitalist and that kind of stuff. So, I wasn't. If I was just left to like. You know, or the regular life or whatever, I probably would have turned out to be some kind of damn liberal, you know, definitely not a conservative. But then really, I mean, I don't know. I think maybe Jeff Riggenbach is right that libertarians are born, and that really always was an individualist anyway. And by the time, I guess Harry Brown, when he ran for president in 1996, that was the first, he and actually a lady on the radio in Austin, Texas named Raleigh James, they were the first people that I had ever heard say, I'm a libertarian and this is what this means and serious about it and good. You know, Harry Brown was great on everything. So I identified very quickly with those guys, the ones who, well, and you know, the John Birchers have a lot of important stuff to say about, for example, how the whole left-wing, liberal, progressive reform movement in government and for the regulatory state and for the welfare state and all that, that was all a right-wing conservative plot of J.P. Morgan in the first place. And those liberals and leftists and progressives were all the useful idiots of the right-wing nationalists, imperialists, who wanted a centralized state in order to guarantee that they wouldn't have to face the risk of the marketplace, and you know, which had been whooping on them lately. And so even though the Birchers have more of a conspiratorial view than I would subscribe to now, you know, that goes off the rails in some ways or whatever, and they're conservatives and I'm not, they still had something going for them there, that this whole dichotomy where business versus government and government versus business is really a lie, and that, you know, we live in a fascist country, really, because the Democrats made it that way. That kind of thing impressed me early on, and that's the kind of thing that Harry Brown and the libertarians aren't conspiracy theorists, but they understand that very same principle, that, you know, the Ford Foundation of zillionaires finances every left-wing radical for the last, you know, 90 years for a reason.
Yeah. Were you ever a Bircher?
No, never right-wing. Never a conservative at all. But I did buy a copy of Waco, The Rules of Engagement from them.
Yeah, I like them. You know, I have issues with them, but as far as right-wing people go or Republican people go or conservative people go, they seem to have it going on more than anybody.
Yeah, I liked them a lot more before they got rid of the heroic William Grigg, from Pro Libertate, who's
great.
He was what was the greatest thing about the John Birch sighting. In fact, right after September 11th, their first issue of the New American came out, and it was all about the firefighter heroes and indulging and all that kind of thing. That's okay. But the second issue that came out was all about don't invade Afghanistan. It's not fair. It was some Saudis and Egyptians there who did it, not, you know, the country of Afghanistan, and don't overthrow Kabul and try to regime change. And if Jesus was here and St. Augustine and held us to the just war standard, this does not qualify. I mean, these are some right-wing flag-waving, suit-wearing Christians here. And they came out saying, don't go to war. Don't let the empire use this as an excuse. Don't give up your Bill of Rights. And that was Will Grigg. I mean, that was why the John Birchers stayed good after September 11th, because of him. And then in like 2006, Lou Dobbs made it a trendy thing to hate Mexicans. And the John Birch company wanted to get on board that, so they got rid of my man, who was the best thing that ever happened to him.
You ever heard the conspiracy theory that the John Birch Society killed JFK?
I've heard, you know, that people think that, yeah, it was, you know, right-wing nationalists in Dallas that did it, but I don't think that that's right.
I don't think it's right either. I'm just surprised of all the kind of JFK conspiracy porn that's out there that's not, you know, because it would be a good one for the list of made-up crap that people say.
Well, and people assume that right away because the Birchers hated him, and they had been putting up, you know, wanted for treason posters everywhere, and he was in Dallas, and, you know, like, it made sense as, you know, the Rachel Maddow of 1963, all the Maddows out there went, of course, the right-wing anti-government movement did it, you know, that kind of thing, jumping the gun. Same way the neocons blamed Oklahoma on Arabs before anybody could show them otherwise.
I think the guy from the FBI, what's the guy that wore women's clothes? I can't remember his name. Hoover. I think he did it, had it done.
I think it was a combination of the mob and the CIA. Who exactly was zooming who? I don't know. In fact, the theory that impresses me the most, and I've never made this one my hobby because there's so many different theories. It's only speculative fun, really. But the one that I like now is that the mob did it, but they did it in such a way that the CIA was totally compromised and had to clamp down the investigation and let them get away with it. Because if they'd been busted for it, then that would have exposed the CIA plot to do a coup d'etat in Cuba. And they had the head of the military in Cuba was CIA and was waiting for the signal to do this coup. And that it was going to screw it all up because the mob had compromised these CIA guys. Anyway, I forgot the name, but there's a great documentary that from that angle. And that's the one I like right now, but I don't really care because he was a president after all. I actually am very annoyed when people, you know, build up JFK into some kind of, you know, Mount Rushmore figure. And he must have been great, or else why would he have been shot? But, you know, scumbags get shot all the time. In fact, scumbags get shot more often than good people, you know?
Yeah. Are you surprised that we can still talk like this on public airwaves and internets and say the things we do?
I think about that sometimes, but the answer is pretty obvious that nobody really cares. We have our niche, and so maybe we'll be happy and pat ourselves on the back when we grow our niche a bit, and we can all thank Ron Paul 10 million fold for all the new anarchists in the world, because for a Republican, he sure does create a lot of anarchists wherever he goes. You know, at the end of the day, the American people don't care whether, I mean, they're against the Afghan war, but they don't really care. They're against the Iran war, but they don't really care. They're against the Patriot Act, but they don't really care. They're against the National Police Force, the DHS, but they don't really give a shit, man. They're not going to do anything. They're not going to do anything. They refuse to even categorize these most important things ever as important at all. I mean, after all, you know, Rick Santorum, now he hates the queers, and I like that. That's the kind of thing that'll get me to vote for a man. And so, you know, I don't see why you and me speaking sense ought to worry them, really, is what I'm getting at.
I'm blown away at how much Ron Paul is getting quashed by the GOP machine and the left and right media. It's, I mean, GOPs, you know, historically are white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, and Ron Paul is a ethical guy and also happens to be a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, and they're fighting over, like, should we vote for the Mormon or the Catholic, you know?
Yeah, it's funny, but you know what they hate more than Mormons and Catholics, those born-agains, is peace. Because peace, that's what the devil says. The devil says that he's going to give you peace. And so you can't ever trust anyone who says peace, not till Jesus comes again. I'm from Texas. I've heard that one before.
You born and raised in Texas?
Well, I moved here when I was 3 months old. I'm sorry, but almost.
From where? You born in New York City?
No, born in Florida. Born in Florida. Moved to Texas very young.
I was making a Hank Hill, King of the Hill joke. Because he's a
true Texan. I'm sorry that I missed it, because that is a good Hank Hill joke.
He's born in the ladies' room of Yankee Stadium in New York City.
But you know what? Florida is a pretty embarrassing place to be born, too. Because it's not the South. It ain't nothing, man. It's just... You ever been to South Florida? It's a terrible place.
Is that Fort Lauderdale? My brother lives there. I've been there. Is that mid-Florida?
Yeah, that's where I lived the first 3 months of my life.
Yep, I've been there.
There's no hills. There's nothing to look at. The ocean's on the wrong side of everything. It's ridiculous.
He lived next door to a swamp. The first night I was there, I heard like a monkey being eaten by an alligator and screaming bloody murder, man. I was like 8. It was horrible.
That's pretty rough, man. Yeah,
my friend and business partner and best friend in the whole world, Nima Vedati, is moving to Austin in a bit. You should meet him at some point. He's a good guy.
Sounds good.
Sure. He quotes you on Freedom Fiends quite often, or talks about
it. You know, someone told me that, actually. Someone in the chat room mentioned that. So, cool. Tell him I'm happy to meet him and show him all 4 of our freeways.
Yep. Oh, he's from there. He grew up there. Okay. But he went to J school at University of Texas and, you know, got a journalism degree and came to Casper, Wyoming and became a news anchor. And that's where I met him, and we made that movie Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom. You have a chance to see that yet?
No, and I have it right here. I just haven't gotten to it. I'm the worst.
And
I'm sorry.
That's all right.
I will, and then that will be the occasion for an interview of you on my show. It'll be great.
Cool. And then you can go have coffee with Nima or something when he gets there. I probably know 10,000 people in the world that, like, you know, I sort of know them. I've met them, or they know my name, or I know their name, or we've exchanged emails, and know a lot of people in person. Of the 10,000 people I know in the world, my wife is the coolest, and Nima is the second coolest. So I have pretty high standards, and I know a lot of people, and he is the second coolest person I know.
Wow. So that's a pretty ringing endorsement, then.
Yep.
All right. Well, I'll take that to heart.
Cool, man. Did you ever read the book from 1970 called Future Shock?
No. Is that the first of the Toffler books?
Yeah.
It is? Good guess, huh?
What's Toffler doing now?
I've heard of it.
Isn't Toffler like working for the military industrial complex now somehow?
I have no idea.
As a consultant?
I don't know.
Yeah. You know who is that other visionary futurist, Kurzweil. You know him? Kurzweil's a visionary. He's a visionary motherfucker. He invented optical character recognition, voice synthesis. Did a lot with computer music, synthesizers, and made billions of dollars, many millions of dollars. Wrote this amazing book called what's it called? He wrote a bunch of books on the future that I really liked, and about like what year computing technology will surpass the human brain, which is, I think, 2024. But he's a big statist, you know, works for the army developing drones and robots and things, the spy bots and hummingbird bots and things like that.
That's horrible.
Or even just like advising the scientists who do, you know, bring in the team leader every once in a while. But Future Shock by Alvin Toffler. This book written in the 70s. It was a bestseller. It was really dry. It was about 600 pages. Kind of read like a doctoral thesis, and I think it may have been. But the basic premise of it was that he brought forth this new term called Future Shock, which was the idea that the exponential growth of technology in the world is getting to the point where people are becoming overwhelmed day by day in the increases. And this is in 1970. And, you know, he pointed out that like in 1970, you know, there were computers and there was a man on the moon and there were people alive who had existed when there were no automobiles, you know, to put it into context. And I think that since 1970 to now, like, you know, in your lifetime, in my lifetime, I think it's even gone further. I think that book, if you read the book, The Jetsons World, it's a Jetsons World.
No, but that sounds fun. Am I going to finally have flying boots?
You know, that's what everyone says about it, but I think that the context of it is that due to
the anarcho-capitalism and Mr. Spacey will be the biggest threat to me.
due to the free market, there have been more vast changes since the show The Jetson was on till now in the cyber world and the data world and the internet world and the connectivity world by far than what there was in The Jetsons world. I mean, The Jetsons world looked cool, but it was really just like slight advancements on what was around. Like, you had rockets and you had cars. They just put them together in there.
We have better communicators than they have on Star Trek, right?
For sure. And I think they're actually inspired. They look like the Star Trek communicators.
Sure.
But the nerds who designed them were Trekkies, so... Yeah, but I've been thinking about Future Shock a lot lately. Do you get overwhelmed at all? Not just by the tyranny, but by the increase of just connectivity and everything. I mean, I really like it, but sometimes it overwhelms me a little bit.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't know if overwhelmed really is the right term for it. The problem is it kind of changes the way that I take in my information to such a vast degree. You know, like, articles just get shorter and shorter and shorter. The more time I spend on Facebook, and really it was when blogs came out in 2005 or whatever the hell, something like that, is when I got my blog. And that really hurt my book reading. But then when Facebook came out, man, I've probably read 10 books since Facebook came. Well, that's not true. Probably 20. But normally... By my old standards, it would have been 200. I used to, you know, always read, you know, a couple of books a week and interview all the authors. Yeah. And then now all the authors send me the books, but I never get to them. And so then I wonder, well, I don't wonder. I can tell that I don't understand the things that I do understand as well, because you just, you know, it's like the difference between watching the nightly news. Never mind, you know, they're lying to you about something, but just a regular news report about something, you know, all things being equal, you know, basically true. Compare the TV news story versus the newspaper story about it. That level of difference, it's the same kind of thing, only to a much greater degree, where if I was really reading all the books that I was sent just over the last 2 years, if I had really read all of them, I would be way better on so many things than I am right now. Like, I really, it's been detrimental to me. I don't know about, you know, I never feel like, oh no, I can't keep up kind of thing, because I always have antiwar.com and Eric and Jason doing all of my dirty work for me, really, collecting all those links. And you know, I know what I want to know about, and I know
staff. They're your research staff.
Yeah, in a way. I mean, I use the site that way, even though I'm a contributor to it. It's also my number one resource. And you know, there's a lot of other sites, too, a lot of places to get a lot of stuff. But, you know, also I'm lucky that if I see an article I like, even if I read through it really fast and I don't necessarily get every little bit of it, I still get to interview the guy that wrote it and ask him all about it and have him elaborate, whatever. But so that's just me cheating and getting away with bloody murder there, you know. It's not fair that I get to get away with that, but I do. But I really want to get back to reading the books. Like, for example, I got an awesome new book today in the mail by Roger Charles, who was the partner of J.D. Cash. And these were, to the best of my knowledge, the two best journalists on the story of who all was really behind the Oklahoma City bombing. And it's called Oklahoma City, what the investigation missed and why it matters. And like, I got two books I got to read, Charles Goyette and one other one I forget now, John Pfeffer, before I get to this one. But I'm dying to get to this, and it's like 500 pages or something, so I'm dying to dive into that thing. The very best of J.D. Cash and Roger Charles's work, that's as good as it's ever going to get on that story right there. So it's worth it to read. You know what you said too reminded me of a book by Neil Postman called, you know, the guy that wrote Amusing Ourselves to Death. He also had one called Technopoly, where he's saying basically the premise is that America is a technopoly, which means a culture where there is no culture, where culture is completely surrendered to new advances in technology, where any gadget, any technology that can be invented will be invented, and as soon as it's cheap enough, it will be implemented. So, like, for example, the cameras in every city in America now. No, not one city council ever held a meeting. There was not one referendum in one county anywhere. I'd be amazed to find out there was. They just put them up. They just watching, put them up everywhere.
I was watching this cop show called Adam 12 from the 70s. You ever seen it?
No, I don't think so.
I saw it as a kid, and I was just rewatching it on Netflix to see like what formed my view of authority, and it was partly this show. And there's a scene in it where there's these two guys following the cops around in their car everywhere they go with a 16 millimeter film camera and a little, you know, reel-to-reel tape recorder, like following the cops and filming them, and the cops are pissed off about it because it's never happened before, you know, because the technology right. to do that then would cost $5,000 and weigh 50 pounds and require two people.
Right.
But yeah, it's like they're fucking everywhere now. Yeah, and as a technology thing, I mean, I write books for a living, and I haven't read a book in 5 years because I'm too busy with the internet, and it's not a bad thing. It's a beautiful thing, you know. It's
trade-off is what it is, you know. To me, it's a trade-off.
I heard someone say last, that guy from the Jetsons world, I heard him last night on, I think, Lou Rockwell, and he said, thanks to the internet, no matter where you live in the world, if you have an internet connection, you now live in the city. You know, you're now part of the city.
That's a good way of saying it.
You're listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast, a tasty stew of freedom and fun. Subscribe at kittyfeet.com. That's KittyFeet.com.
So I want to ask you a little bit about your show and your history with it. And do you make a living at it?
Yes. One of my primary responsibilities, well, really my primary responsibility for antiwar.com is the interview archive. So whatever radio show I'm doing, almost all, like, you know, 99 out of 100 interviews are about foreign policy anyway, pretty much, because that's all I care about anyway. So, or stuff that's close enough, you know, domestic police state stuff, national security state kind of stuff, you know. So that's one of my responsibilities for them. And then, of course, I'm also an assistant editor, and I'm responsible for other things as well there. But that's how I make my money off of the show. I basically have a job at antiwar.com, and that's one of my responsibilities is coming up with interviews. So I'm basically doing, I insist on being on some kind of radio anyway, even if I just got to sit here in my own living room talking to myself or something. So I figured out a way to, you know, somebody's interested in my interview archive. It's Eric Garris and his audience.
I'll pitch Nima as an interview again. His dad is from Iran and moved here right before the revolution. And he grew up in Texas, but he's an ANCAP, anti-war guy, who has an interesting take on it, which, you know, basically comes down to, don't blow up my grandpa.
Cool. Hey, does he write articles?
He can write. I've never seen him write an article. He's done a lot more spoken stuff, video stuff and spoken stuff, but he helped co-write, you know, the text in the movie, and he's great at it. And he's
that might be okay. I guess typically the way I do the show is I don't go by the person. I go by the thing that they wrote that I want to ask them about, basically, is the structure. So I guess, you know, if there was a specific YouTube where he's making a specific case or something that I'd like to follow up on, that kind of thing. Otherwise, I don't know how to conduct an interview unless I'm saying, yeah, but you say here this, but what about that kind of thing,
yep.
you know?
Yep.
Get Makes right sense. To the heart of the matter.
So since this is a podcaster's podcast and a Radio Man's radio show, ask you a little about tech stuff. What kind of microphone, gear, processing, compressors, preamps, etc. do you use? And are you using it all now?
I am using it all now. I'm sitting in my office where I have all my radio rig. Let's see, I guess after Chaos Radio got shut down for the second time in what would have been, I guess, say 2006. Since then, I had to basically start from scratch and build my own kind of home studio, one little piece at a time. And so I have my one computer that's dedicated to streaming out to LRN and recording the show. Then I got my main computer that also plays, like, if I want to play Ron Paul audio on the show or whatever. And then I got a Yamaha board and a Gentner XAP-TH1 foam patch. And two DBX compressors.
How much did the phone patch cost?
The phone patch, and I think this company went out of business or something, but a friend got this for me on eBay for, I think it was $200, something like that.
Because we looked,
it's a good little piece of equipment. Yeah. It's very sturdy and reliable.
$200's cheap for that. I mean, they new. It's, was it used or new?
Oh, I think it was like new.
Yeah, because I've looked into that, and like, you know, the rack mount ones are like, with balanced outputs, are like $700 to $800. And
It's been quite a few years since I got this thing, but I don't. It couldn't have been more than five.
Yeah, but we looked into that, and we're like, we don't want to be. We don't, you know. We did Freedom Fiends for a year, and then we started doing the Freedom Fiends live on Sundays in addition on LRN, and we just didn't. You know, it's like I could have come up with the money, but I really didn't want to for that. And what we did was we just have a second computer running Skype, and we got a paid Skype number, which is $18 every 3 months. And then just put the inputs and outputs into the mixer. And it sounds pretty damn good. We have callers call in on phones or on Skype, and it just goes into the mixer.
Cool. Yeah, I need to work that out.
What, getting Skype into your show?
Yeah. Like, for example, right now I'm talking to you on this Mumble, but you're not being recorded on my recorder. Only I am.
Well, you actually
the way
could.
It's coming in and whatever. So I don't know if I'd need a whole new laptop or how the hell I would work that out.
To record with Mumble, that little red button on Mumble, if you hit that, you'll start recording on your end, both of us.
Get both of us if I just record it inside the Mumble program itself. Yeah.
But I'm also going to have this up probably 2 hours after we're done talking. So
I just meant that, for example.
Yeah.
I just, you know, I'm plain old telephone service here because what the hell do I know? Not much.
Yeah, well, you wouldn't need to go to what I'm talking about unless you wanted to be able to take, since you have a solution that works.
No, I would like to be able to take phone calls from my callers in a way that's workable live and stack them up on hold and have them know that they're the one I'm talking about when I say you're the one who's next. You know, typically that would mean a k in their ear, right, as the phone patch tests the line, that kind of thing. Then they know that they're the one who's up. I haven't been able to work that out, and I'd love to hear ideas now or later. Or
I can send you my blog post on how we're doing this with Skype, but we do not have the Skype can put people on hold, but the way we're doing it on the show, you actually hear the little Skype do-do-do-do.
I hate all that, man. Yeah. That's got to get all cleaned up. It's got to be better than that. Or otherwise, I mean, the way I do it, I have a phone, but I just call my guests with it, and that's it. I still haven't been able to figure out, and I'd love to take calls. I'd make the whole show structured around taking calls, even for the guests too, probably, if I could figure out a way to do it other than, you know, paying to have 10 lines installed and 800 number and all this crap. And everybody says, I know what to do, but it's never really right. No, I mean, I've heard it all.
I know what to do, and it would work, and I'll send you a blog post on it. Basically, you'd spend $18 every 3 months for a Skype number, which is they give you a real phone number in whatever area code you want. And in some area codes, you can even pick one that spells something. We couldn't find one in Wyoming. And then you'd have it on a second computer with Skype. You'd have it going into the channel on the mixer that's turned down. And then you would you'd just watch the Skype out of the corner of your eye, and you'd see when there's an alert of someone coming in. You'd answer it. You'd be answering it on the air unless you had a second person there to screen it. And a submix on the mixer, but that might be a solution. What kind of mic do you use?
We need to work that out. A Sennheiser, just a regular directional stage mic.
Oh,
because I don't have like a soundproof studio or whatever. Yeah. It's just an office at my house, so I figured just a plain old
dynamic mic that doesn't pick up the crickets down the block like my mic does.
Nothing too fancy.
Yeah,
and it picks up more than plenty. Thanks.
Yeah, I use a condenser mic for Mumble recordings because it has better clarity, and then for the weekly podcast that I do with Dima that's not live, we both use Ribbon mics, which have just an unbelievably sexy like 50s sound. It's great.
Cool.
Yeah, we're fucking geeks.
I'd like to know more about that kind of stuff, but I'm just trying to figure out the hell's going on in Syria, you know.
maybe my preoccupation with this kind of stuff is part of how I am not overwhelmed by what's going on in Syria. It's my drug, you know. The tech stuff's my drug.
Yeah. Well, yep. I basically have learned just enough to get by. Is my level of technical skill.
Your stuff sounds good. It sounds good. And normally, I mean, if I hadn't said let's do Mumble and hook all this crap up, what would you have done? Phone call with me or Skype with me? What would you normally want to do?
Yeah, what I would have done is I would have just called you on my phone. And then however you receive it. And then I would have hit the phone patch button and I would have talked to you through my microphone and hope that microphone, mixing board, phone patch, phone line sounds better than just talking with the handset microphone. Yeah. And I don't, that's a gamble. I don't really know. Maybe it's not as good, but I think it should be better.
That's one reason I started this podcast.
My voice sounds deeper at night. I need to move my show to nighttime.
Hi, here you are on Anti-War Radio.
Yeah, sound like I'm still smoking.
Barry White. I quit smoking and got on the Vaporsmiths, the electronic cigarettes. You tried those? Oh, you don't need nicotine anymore.
Man, I was wanting to quit. I actually sort of kind of tried, and it didn't really take, but I knew it wasn't really right. And then like 2.5 weeks later, something like that, I was like, all right, that's it. This is the one. Forget it. And then that was it. That was like 2.5 months ago. So far, I'm hanging in there.
Well, your microphones will thank you. Smoke's really bad for microphones.
Yeah. Sounds reasonable.
Yeah, because it coats the diaphragm and makes it, you know, or the element, whatever is receiving the sound, and makes it move less freely. Makes it heavier. You know, it'd be kind of like if somebody put Vaseline in your ears, you know?
Right. I would not want that.
Which is illegal in 7 states in the District of Columbia.
Probably.
How many gigabytes a day of downloads do you get from Anti-War Radio? Do you know?
No. You got to ask Sneaker.
Okay.
Sneaker knows.
Do you, who's your hosting and what does it cost a month? Because I'm paying like $75 a month now for my hosting.
All of my hosting is donated.
Nice.
I got some really good fans. I got one guy named Dan who ever since 2003 said, oh man, you need a place to put your audio? I got a server. Upload away, my friend. And he's been, let's see, he hosts still, I think, everything that I, all the interviews anyway that I did up through end of 2005. And then I've got my own servers now for everything since then.
You mean at your house or you?
No, all through various volunteers and fans of the show who have chipped in their expertise and that kind of stuff.
We did something interesting this week that a fan helped with that I'll turn you on to, which is something I think more Liberty people should look into. While we are paying for our hosting, which is in California, for the freedomfiends.com site and for kittyfeet.com, which is the Anarchy Gumbo podcast that you're on. That's a domain that I've had since 1976. It was like my first domain on the internet, and I just kept it and decided this is what, instead of going and getting anarchygumbo.com or something, I was like, kittyfeet isn't doing anything now. Let's do something cool with that.
Had that URL since 1976? Is that
96, what you said? 96. Did I say 76? There were not.
Yeah, you might have. And I was thinking, wow, man, are you from DARPA or something?
Yes, I am from DARPA. No, I got on the web in 1995, got a website in 96, was on the internet in about 92 at the San Francisco Public Library when I lived there using Gopher. And actually, the first time I touched a computer was in 1974. I played tic-tac-toe with the mainframe at Dartmouth College when my sister was going there. But no, cool. Yeah. No, but what we did was we have a fan in Prague, Czech Republic, who had a bunch of server space, but it wasn't set up for web server. It was set up for FTP, which is just download, like through a really simple, you know, it looks like a bunch of folders on your computer. And he donated a bunch of gigabytes of that to us. And we put all of our back casts and our Guns and Weed movie for free download on there. And then registered the domain. He registered for us the domain name freedomfiends.cz, which is a Czech Republic domain. And what the advantage of that is not controlled by the United States Internic. So it would be kind of SOPA proof. It'd be a lot harder for the government to bring down that site. So if the government decided that Freedom Fiends was a threat to national security, or, you know, they found a blog post where we grabbed a picture off the internet of a cat and used it for something, and said that's a copyright violation and took us down, which I think they may start doing at some point with some law to Liberty sites, our .cz site would still be up. It would take like NATO to take that down, or the EU, you know.
Which can be arranged too. Don't test them and give them a blueprint, you know.
Well, we call it the Freedom Fiends drone proof media bunker. So we're taunting them already. So you got pets?
I do. I have a big white cat with one eye named Man who will scratch you and does not like anyone. And then I have another dog and a cat that came with the wife.
Wow. Nima's got a one-eyed dog. It's a Malamute or a Husky. It's a Malamute that he got, and it only had one eye. It functions fine unless there's like a creature coming up on the blind side of it. It gets kind of nervous.
Yeah. Cats are great, man.
Cats are great. Cats are kind of libertarian. Dogs are kind of socialist, but I still love them. But
I see what you mean.
Yeah. So sex. I ask everybody about sex. Do you want to talk about sex?
Nah, come on. Let's talk about Syria.
Okay. Talk about Syria. Okay, I got a question for you. Are you a gun guy?
No, not personally. I mean, guns are fun, but honestly, I've never been able to afford them. I don't have a thing for them. I've shot them a few times and always enjoyed it. But I'm, of course, all about gun rights because I'm an individualist. So I'm always for guns, even if I'm not, all about them myself. But maybe I should be. Maybe I should get like a big badass Desert Eagle or something. What do you think?
Well, if you ever want to get a gun and don't want to spend a lot of money, call me up or email me and I'll give you some suggestions for different types of guns that would, for under $200 or $300 that would be good choices.
I guess that's one of the reasons, too, that I haven't really got into them is because I think there's so much to learn about them.
It's a whole other
world. All the different kinds.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I'm not a drinker, but, there's so many different kinds of beers. And if you want to be an expert in, this one's a little hoppier and this one's a little maltier and blah, 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 you can go on forever like that. And it's sort of like JFK conspiracy theories. It's a black hole. You know what I mean? There's so many things to learn about guns. I'd have to just give up foreign policy and learn about guns now.
You wouldn't have to though. I mean, you could also just buy a snub nose 5-shot revolver and get a pocket holster and just stick it in your pocket. I mean, it is an endless amount of depth to fall into. I mean, it's the same thing with computers and with liberty. But really, it's like, it isn't. Liberty boils down to don't hit other people and keep your word, Don't aggress on others and keep your word. That's liberty. That's fucking liberty right there. And that'd be having a snub-nosed revolver in your pocket.
Are you a Richard Mayberry fan?
Yeah, I am. I actually wrote a book called The User's Manual for the Human Experience, which extrapolates on his only two rules of life and applies them to kind of self-help with getting bad people out of your life. It's a libertarian self-help book. Yeah, I'm a fan of his. I've not read a lot of his stuff, but I read a blog post about the only two rules in life, and it just slayed me. I was like, this is what I've been fucking looking for my whole life,
Yeah, he sums it up real well, doesn't he?
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. I kind of like his whole theory, too, of he calls it chaos Stan, where he sort of goes through the history of how the individualist kind of flavor of the Enlightenment started getting more collectivist as it headed eastward. And then Marx came, and Hegel was a big blow to Locke, and all Hegel ever wanted to be was Locke, right? But he kind of screwed it all up and made it a very collectivist status kind of liberal enlightenment. And then Marx was the death of liberalism forever. And that geographically speaking, I mean, this is hyperbole, obviously, when you're talking about ideas spreading or whatever. Oops, sorry about that. it quit spreading east. And so for him, and this is a pretty black and white way of looking at things, but for Mayberry, he just says, pretty much Germany too, but certainly everything east of Germany is chaos, Stan, where nobody respects property rights and they never will. And and of course, then his lesson is, so stay the hell out of there with your military because you're never going to be able to remake it in your image. You're never going to be able to tame it like America's Old West or something like that. So just leave them to their devices because it's always going to be warring tribes of people fighting, and we should not turn ourselves into barbarians trying, in the name of, it's all narrow, selfish interests, of course, but always claiming that it's a white man's burden type of Coney, build a democracy under Hamid Karzai kind of a project, and he's saying, just give it up, quit trying, because it won't ever work, not until they learn John Locke, and that ain't going to happen because Marx already ruined it.
You know who's a Mayberry fan is Jack Endino of Sub Pop Records, who produced all, the first few Nirvana records and everything on Sub Pop. Kind of surprising. Interesting. He's a sort of buddy of mine. He was a fan of my band Bomb, my band from San Francisco back in the day. And I learned about Mayberry from Boston Tea Party, who is a guy I like a lot. I like his stuff a lot. He's
yeah, I've read one book by him.
Which one?
I forget, but it's yellow and it's about protecting your rights from the cops.
You and the Police.
Exactly.
Great book. That was my introduction to liberty, and that's what quotes Mayberry.
Really?
Yeah. It was basically, it was like, you know, I was always kind of a Democrat. I was anti-war first. Then I was a lazy Democrat who didn't like authority for most of my life. And then someone tried to break into our house in L.A. about 5 years ago. And I said, honey, we're buying a gun. And we bought a gun and then bought dozens more and learned how to use them. And, you know, my wife was against it at first, but now she carries a gun in her purse and wouldn't leave home without it anymore. And she'd leave without her phone or her keys or her car. And what happened was, we bought the gun, you know, we bought one shotgun, and then we started to study the laws in California, and we were like, we're going to be criminals. We're honest people, but we're going to be criminals in California because the gun laws are so narrowly defined. And then I was buying a gun book on Amazon, and it said, people who bought this book also bought You and the Police by Boston Tea Party. And I bought that. I read it in one sitting. It was my introduction to liberty, and it was also my introduction to the idea of open carry, which was mind-blowing to me because I wanted to get a concealed carry permit in California, and there was no way legally to do it. And I was like, wait, there are states where you can just put a gun on your hip and walk around with it. And by, you know, 6 hours later, after reading that book, I woke my wife up in the morning and said, honey, we're moving to Wyoming. And 9 months later, we lived here. So that was my journey with it. I like something that Boston said, too, about libertarians should own guns. And, you know, this isn't a violent militia kind of attitude. It's a just protect yourself kind of attitude. He said, if your whole life view is based on not initiating aggression, what do you have to protect yourself when someone initiates aggression on you other than wriggling like a fish and screaming? And he said, to bring it back to John Locke, he said, you know, when the redcoats came in and oppressed the fuck out of the people at Lexington and Concord, the Patriots didn't stand there quoting John Locke at them. They shot them, and they shot them well.
There are times like that.
What do you think about the Revolutionary War in America? Do you think that was an ethical war?
Well, you know, it always seemed to me that it was a defensive war, and I guess as of the last maybe decade or so, I've wondered more and more whether it was still the right decision in that. And I never crunched the numbers myself, Michael, I don't know. But they say that, you know, the taxes were three times what they used to be after the war. And, you know, they made a giant empire. Well, it killed more people than the Nazis. Yeah, so what the hell, you know?
And it could not be done right now. I mean, I think that it was a weird combination of facts that enabled the colonists to win that war. And part of it was the fact that the people oppressing them lived a 3-week ship ride away. You know, now they just come in, and now if you tried to even think about that kind of shit, they just take a bear cat and run over your house or drone you.
Yeah. Well, see, that's the whole thing is back then the weapons were pretty much equally distributed among the people in the state. But now the state has a specialization of weaponry that, you know.
Yeah. I mean,
well,
now
we all have our own Apache helicopters and we're going to have our private fleet face them down and declare our liberty one day or whatever like that. They, you know, I'm trying to remember who was wise and said this, that maybe it was even Carol Quigley who said, it's only the old law that really protects us. The law that was written back then when the arms were distributed equally, I think it was Quigley, and that now once we give up our Bill of Rights and, you know, only our unanimous and fervent opinion can save it, once we give that up, once we give up on the old processes that guaranteed our liberty, we'll have nothing to guarantee our liberty at all. Because when it comes down to the, I mean, what, you probably saw the thing the other day where Homeland Security bought 450 million rounds of ammunition or whatever. You can't go up against that, man.
Well, yeah, and that's handgun ammunition, and no wars were ever won with handguns. They were won with rifles. Well, but, you know, back then in 1775,
bad example,
like,
then
it was like, well, no, I mean, that's more of like buying more slaves' whips. You know, that's to give 40 caliber government purchased Glocks to, you know, school What's the guy that goes around when you miss class? You know, they want to arm
all monitor.
Yeah, they want to arm the truancy guys too. That's not that's to arm anybody who's been hired by the Fed goonocracy off a pizza box, and they do advertise on pizza boxes now.
You're listening to the Anarchy Gumbo podcast. That proves you're smarter than most people.
Yeah, I mean, they bought a bunch of handgun, millions of handgun bullets. That's to give the postal inspectors and, you know, basically the hall monitors of America guns, which those people didn't used to have guns. There's an interesting list on Wikipedia of the different categories of people in America that have the power of arrest. Have you ever looked at that one?
No, that sounds interesting. But wait, let me say one thing real quick about the number of armed bureaucrats. You know, Ron Paul's always talking about the hundreds of thousands of armed bureaucrats, or whatever. But you mentioned J. Edgar Hoover, the cross-dressing head of the FBI who may or may not have been involved in the murdering of the president.
That's what it said on his business card, actually.
Oh, yeah. I may or may not have been involved in the murder of the president. Yeah. Or cross-dressing head of the FBI.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, they just came out with a movie about that. And all about him. And one of the things in there is that the line is that, well, the FBI is not allowed to carry guns, and the Congress likes it that way. And the Congress back then at least pretended they had this attitude that they hated the executive branch, that they wanted to limit it all the time. And J. Edgar Hoover's goons, he had to buy guns with his salary to give to all the goons, or he'd go out with state police and arm them up with extra guns to go and enforce his stuff, because he wasn't allowed, the federal bureaucrats weren't allowed to carry guns at all. And that was just in the 1930s. And, you know, they pretend like, oh, it's just always been this way and we'd all be dead without Homeland Security now or whatever. But this is in that movie, they really show how it just hasn't been that long at all since this revolution in who's zooming who here. Yeah.
And that movie, it sounds good. I saw the previews of it. I'm interested in seeing it. But it's like, I think that got made because that cross-dressing guy was a right-wing tyrant. Where is fucking Hollywood and the left's outrage at Obama? I mean, those people were out in the streets screaming that Bush is a Nazi. And now that there's like a hip, younger, black, you know, cool Nazi, where are those people?
Well, come on. I mean, when you're a libertarian, it's especially easy to see how it works on the liberals and the conservatives. It's the same thing back in the 1990s when, oh, the right-wingers, man, they just hated the U.S. government. The jackbooted thugs, those same darn bureaucrats, you know. And then by 1998, turns out the problem is Bill Clinton. And once we're rid of Bill Clinton and the adults are back in charge, yeah, George Bush, he may not be that bright, but he's surrounded by really good people. And when the adults get back in Washington, D.C., then you know what? I love the state. And then once America gets attacked once, oh, I love the state more than my own family. Oh, I love the state so much. Here's my tiny toddler to frisk. I love the state so much. Sure, you can have the National Police Force that my great-grandfather would have gone to war over the creation of. Sure, you can do whatever you want. You can invade whoever you want. You can drone attack whoever you want. And in fact, if you look at Obama's worst outrages, the assassination, the claimed power to assassinate American citizens, the Republicans are silent on that. Oh, he wants to take over healthcare, and we totally agree with Scott and Michael and the libertarians on how much we're opposed to that. But he.
Hello? Hello, hello. Hello? Hello?
Chance, but if Mitt Romney wins and he goes to war with, you know, name it, and passes Patriot Act 2, 3, 4, and 5 and whatever, then the right wing will line up right behind him, and they just flip-flop back and forth. You know, all these people crying now about Operation Gun Runner and whatever, they wouldn't care if it was George Bush doing that, you know.
Well, George Bush was,
I guess it did happen
that.
During him
that.
Right. Yeah, hey, yeah, like, but really if it quick, was George Bush still in power, they wouldn't be saying anything about it at all. It would have already been blown over.
Let me interject here for a sec. I lost you for about 30 seconds. You came back in when you said the word Romney. I don't know if it was the NSA censoring us or if it was just a glitch of the interwebs.
Oh, no.
Do you know what you said in there?
Yeah, fat chance, but if it was Mitt Romney, then and he went to war against whoever, if he passed 4 more Patriot Acts, then all of the conservatives would all be lockstep behind him. The very same people who are complaining about what Obama does now You know, and then I was saying that if I guess it was under George Bush that it happened, but if it was still George Bush in power when the story about Operation Gunrunner and all that came out, then it would have blown over real quick like Hurricane Katrina or whatever, you know?
Well, yeah, the Republicans are actually bipartisan with Obama when it comes to warmongering. It's the only place they agree with him. And, you know, on the other hand, the only place that Obama has actually stimulated the economy is in gun sales.
Yeah, well, and F-35s that don't work.
I don't think
there's actually a hilarious article in McClatchy today about a F-16 factory in Fort Worth where they quote all these, you know, just regular Joe workers at the Lockheed plant going, oh, I've made a real good living working here. Oh, yeah, it's great money building F-16s. And they just talk about how, yes, this whole sector, this whole part of Fort Worth is completely dependent on and built around this Lockheed plant that's made thousands of F-16s and spread them to the four corners of the earth.
That's part of the, well, that's the biggest part, I think, of undoing the cult of the state, undoing the church of the state, which, you know, I heard an interesting thing the other day. Do you know a guy named Bad Quaker?
No.
Really excellent podcast. He calls himself Bad Quaker because he's a Quaker who carries a gun, and Quakers are supposed to be completely, you know, curl up in a ball when attacked. He said something that I'd never really thought of before. Was he was talking about the difference between the government and the state, and I had previously used those as interchangeable thoughts. And he said, no, the government is everything that's in place, the systems, the paychecks, the bombs, the buildings, the laws, you know, the Bearcats. The state is the state of mind that enables that to keep going. This, you know, and basically, like, the state could disappear and the government would exist for 3 days or a week until they just auctioned everything off. But they are different things. And he said, you know, you cannot attack the government. It would crush you like a bug. Like, I personally think they're kind of backing off on crushing gun rights. You know, Obama may do it in his second term if he gets one, but I think they're kind of backing off on crushing gun rights because it doesn't really matter if you have a rifle that you can shoot somebody at a quarter mile with now if you're good, because they can just fucking blow your house up with flying robots. I think now that they have flying robots, it doesn't matter if you have a rifle and you're a good shot. So,
well, plus,
you know,
it's really bad politics. The Democrats, I think they finally learned after just getting beaten down over and over and over again that every time they say they want to take people's guns, that people just go absolutely wild, man. They're just not going to put up with it.
Yeah.
There's just no way. And they don't have to shoot about it. They just will not vote for a damn Democrat ever again. I mean, I've heard people say, you know what? I hear one more Democrat say gun control, I'm going to scream, and that'll be it. And I'll never go near another Democrat. You know, it's bad for their brand to be the gun controllers. It really is.
There's Democrats that like to hunt deer, you know, that don't want their guns taken away.
And they actually have like a whole branding thing. I think they probably paid some money on Madison Avenue to try to bring back up a little bit of the old Southern Dixiecrat type Democrat. The idea that a Democrat is a man with a rifle out in nature somewhere, you know, or whatever, not necessarily a hippie out in nature. You know, bring back that idea, you know, like a Camel ad from the early 80s or whatever, you know, guy out there with his tent and a cigarette.
Not that long ago, a Southern Democrat was a member of the KKK with a gun. So, but they kind of, they've whitewashed that completely. They're like,
well, look at Barack Obama. He's the grand dragon of the Ku Klux Klan Libya right now.
Yeah.
He's leading the big. Huh?
Okay, wait. Before we get into foreign policy, which I'm just going to wind you up and let you go because you are on. You're always on. And, you know, we're back to the thing, as you say. So we're back to the thing. I had one question, and it has escaped my mind. Do you get hate mail from, like, pro-American, USA, fuck yeah?
Not anymore, man. Not anymore. And you know what? They never apologized. They never came back and said, yeah, man, okay, you were right. I mean, you know, I screamed myself hoarse for just years saying, you know, and in fact, especially like 2005, right around there, we would get letters from soldiers who would come. I remember how I had some debates with some soldiers where it started out, you know, where they're just so mad and we're a traitor and cut and run and slogan this and slogan that and all this stuff. And then I would always, you know, I mean, it was my job, especially the letters that came by way of antiwar.com. I have to keep it cool, you know? So I would always just try to break it down and just say, like, okay, dude, you and your guys go on missions, successful ones, all the time against the bad guys. But who's who? Do you know whose side you're on, really? Who among the Iraqi factions is your ally? And who's inheriting Baghdad? And what role are you playing in the war on the ground there? And if you even ask these questions, and the first couple of days worth of answers you get will prove to you that you're not fighting for freedom for Iraq. You're not over there saving America. You're sure as hell not over there saving Iraqis. You're turning them over to people who put drills in their heads when they get out of line. And people who don't need you and are going to kick your ass out anyway at the end. And now look at us. You know, it's 2012 now. Finally, my point is proven by the fact. That's it. There's nothing left to argue. They kicked us out. We fought for people who didn't need us. And you know, have quite unceremoniously denied us all the imperial possessions that all our guys bled for. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing, you understand. I'm just making the point that I was right this whole time. And I would sometimes get through to those soldiers and they would say, well, you know what, maybe I don't know enough about Muqtada al-Sadr, but still, you should try to support us more and whatever. And I would just tell them, man, don't you think you should be safe and sound at home at Fort Hood or Fort Bliss or whatever, instead of out there getting shot at for nothing, fighting for a bunch of Iranians in Iraq? You know, it's crazy, dude. And so there were times where I would get across to them. I don't think any of them ever said sorry. Certainly they never came back like years later saying, wow, if only I had known then what I know now. We just don't ever get that. Not that I guess that's to be expected, really, but, you know, I guess I kind of thought we would get a few like that, you know?
You know, I used to, I've been sober. I used to be a bad drinker and had a little problem with the needle too. And I got sober in 94 and I've been sober since then. And I went to AA for like 10 years. I don't go anymore, but in AA, I used to sponsor the guys that were unsponsorable, that like no one else would deal with anymore because they just kept relapsing and just kept relapsing. And, you know, I had, over the years, probably 30 or 40 guys I had as sponsees that almost all of them just relapsed repeatedly. And I'd let them call me up at 3 a.m. I'd have them over for dinner. I'd cook them spaghetti with my last dollar. I'd really go to bat to help these guys. And it helped me. It helped me stay sober. But none of those fuckers stayed sober. And I loved them all. And they just, none of them stayed sober. And like 5 or 6 years after I quit doing that, I started getting letters from emails. Those guys would find me on Facebook or find me on the internet before Facebook and be like, hey, I want to thank you because you took time with me when no one else would. And I finally got it. And I've been sober for 3 years now. And you helped me back in the day. And I got like 6 or 7 letters like that. And then I heard from other people that a couple of those other guys stayed sober and never contacted me either. So, mm-hmm. You know, we plant the seed and then we move on, I think is what it is with Liberty. You know, it's just, I use AA methodology with Liberty. You know, I plant the seed and I go on and I try to carry the message and not carry the addict, but carry the message. And I think it's the same thing with Liberty. So I think you're reaching people and I think you're making a difference. And just because they don't send you a plaque and a ham doesn't mean you didn't get through, you know?
But I love ham. But yeah, you're right. And, you know, I get emails from people saying you really changed my mind, but it's never, I just think it would have been nice to just get one saying, dear antiwar.com, I was the guy that said that you were worse than the devil for being such traitors back in 2004. And I just wanted to say that. Okay, or something.
Do you have a sense of patriotism in any way?
Well, you know, I grew up on all that stuff, just like everybody.
More to Texas than America.
Here, you know, yeah, I really do have a lot more like emotional tie to Texas than the U.S. as a whole.
My wife grew up in Texas, and my best friend did, so I understand how there's almost more nationalism for Texas than there is for America in Texas. You know,
that's how it used to be, I think, back in the days. You know, like Thomas Jefferson always considered Virginia his country, and America was just the union that Virginia was part of, kind of thing. That's basically how Texans look at it. I think it's probably not that way in all those square-shaped states out there, you know?
Well, you know, speaking of the square-shaped states, you know, Wyoming, and when people say, where do you live, I don't want to tell them right away, I say I live in one of the square states, which means the ones that are shaped square, but it also, they're kind of square, but they're also, yeah. I like living in them better because I can walk around with a gun, and, you know, it's a bunch of right-wing tyrants instead of left-wing tyrants like it was in California, but the right-wing tyrants tend to leave you alone as neighbors more and leave you alone on the street more and get less up in your business, you know, they don't care so much if you want to smoke a cigarette
Wyoming is beautiful, man. What a great place to live.
It is. The part of it that I live in, Casper, the right hand, so the east side of it, is not beautiful in a gorgeous, like, Jackson, Wyoming kind of way. It's more like, it looks like the moon with sage grass, but I like it. It's beautiful to me because there's so few people here, and I don't like being crowded in. You know, Wyoming, part of Wyoming was actually part of the Republic of Texas. It extended up to about Cheyenne. Do you know that?
I did know that. I mean, I've seen maps of Texas where the panhandle goes way up north there, but yeah. I didn't realize that they claimed past Colorado, huh?
Yep.
And that's pretty brave for a bunch of Texicans, but I guess so.
So we got about 10 minutes left here. You wanted to talk about Syria. Wind you up about Syria and just go.
Well, first of all, I was going to say real quick about Obama being the imperial grand dragon of Libya, where we just fought a war for basically Al-Qaeda and a bunch of just marauding madmen, Mad Max-style craziness, and wholesale persecution of blacks. And it's almost unbelievable, like, to see, if you go especially to Russia Today, but I think it just got out everywhere. It's Libyan blacks rounded up and being held in a zoo on their knees, handcuffed with Libyan flags, rebel flags stuffed down their throats. And this is all just based on the rumor that, oh, they all work for Gaddafi somehow, or they're all, you know, this terrible foreign element. That's the excuse, or they're all mercenaries for Gaddafi or whatever. And a reporter that I've talked to for years now, David Enders, who's now writing for McClatchy, he interviewed like a score of women in this refugee camp who the marauding bandits that America just supported in the war there are coming in every night and mass raping them. And I mean, good journalism. You can read it. It's by David Enders at McClatchy. It's madness going on there. And they just decided ever since Gaddafi got shot in the head that just forget it. We came, we saw, he died, and now never you mind about Libya anymore.
Well, if you want to go back to the where's the outrage, you know, there's this just constant, everyone's lips are talking about this Trayvon Martin case of this, you know, this black kid got killed and Obama came out and said, and it's a terrible situation and nobody really knows which side is in the right on that, if either of them. And Obama came out and said, if I had a son, he'd look like Trayvon. I saw a comment the other day of, I saw a picture, someone posted a picture of Alalaki's kid, you know, the 16-year-old American citizen.
Right. Yeah, that's going out on Facebook.
And it was a picture of him, and it said, if Obama had a son. If Obama had a son, he'd really look like that guy. That guy looked like Obama's kid. Where's the outrage, man?
Yeah, I don't know. Well, you know, people, and there's been so many of these, whether you talk about the different plague outbreaks that are about to happen or whatever, it almost makes me want to believe like the worst conspiracy theories about MK Ultra and whatever. But you know, it's not even that. All it is just Walter Lippmann and propaganda. All it is just, you know, Noam Chomsky probably wrote about it 25 years ago or whatever. The newspaper, particularly the Post and the Times, and then, you know, therefore TV, they tell, well, especially, I mean, that's on news stuff, but on TV entertainment too, they tell people what to think and people follow those cues. I mean, something that really, you know, caught my attention was I watch very little TV, but all of a sudden I started downloading entire seasons of Curb Your Enthusiasm and Penn and Teller Bullshit and a few others. And I'm watching these things, a few of these different series, like season after season kind of. And there's just no, and this is, you know, the last decade. And there's just no mention of the war at all. The only reference to the war in all of Curb Your Enthusiasm is a soldier in the background at the airport. I mean, that is it. It just, there is no character in any TV show where, you know, Jimmy, the neighbor kid or whatever, is always on the computer reading about the news and complaining. They don't even have a stereotype character like that. Jimmy, who's, never mind antiwar.com, how about just reading and complaining about the war at all? You don't have any character like that anywhere in popular music, on television, and so people just follow that cue doesn't matter.
I've been watching these shows from the 60s, Adam 12, these cop shows that I watched as a kid. Every third episode has a bunch of anti-war demonstrators in it. You know, the cops are called out to deal with the anti-Vietnam War demonstrators down at the college who were breaking windows or so. You know, most of them are peaceful, and then one of them is breaking a window or making a bomb, and the police go deal with that. But it came up back then. Let's put it that way.
Right. And I mean, it really, to me, is something behold. I remember I was sitting in my truck in LA waiting for somebody, and I had an antiwar.com sticker on the back window of my truck. And this kid and his girlfriend walked by. The kid, he's 22, 23 year old kid or something. And he just goes, anti-war. Like, Jesus. The way he said it was just the idea that anyone could give a shit at all to be against war was so foreign to him. It was like the sticker said pro rollerblader or something. It was just like, are you fucking kidding me? Anti-war? Like, that is the stupidest, most irrelevant thing. Now, all of that was packed into his voice, I swear. That was in it. Anti-war.
Well, I
like
think that,
and it wasn't that he was pro-war. It was that he didn't care about that at all. He never heard of someone caring about that.
Yeah. I think in the 60s, it was closer to home because everybody's dad had gone to World War II, and, you know, some of them came back missing parts of their body, and if they didn't, they certainly probably told some horrifying stories around dinner. So people knew about it.
Yeah. Well, now it's just...
And now everyone's going over there and getting parts of their bodies blown off. And even so, like, you know, there'll be this sort of hagiography, puppy parade, hero worship. Oh, this is so great. But that's the only mention you hear of it. You'll hear of some, you know, help buy the soldiers better prosthetic legs charity, maybe on Fox. But, you know, you don't hear... I don't hear people college age saying, yeah, my buddy just came back from war and he's missing an arm, and that's happening.
Yeah. Hey, this is part of my excuse for where this conversation kind of started about how I was for the first Gulf War just because I was a stupid 14-year-old freshman high school kid, and I just liked explosions and jet planes and stuff. One of the things that happened to me about that first Gulf War was that a year and a half later or something, I just heard like a offhand reference in different contexts, but somebody just referenced that there had been people chanting no blood for oil in giant anti-war protests down at the Texas State Capitol. And man, when the first Gulf War was going on, I was, yeah, a ninth grade kid, but I was watching the news. I was watching the news a lot. That was all I cared about. And yeah, local news too, I'm sure. And I had never heard that there had been any organized outside protest of hippies or anybody anywhere in America against that war. TV, as a, you know, as a 14-year-old vast consumer of electronic, you know, communication such as it was then, I was never once exposed to the fact that there was an anti-war protest anywhere in America for like a year and a half. Then I was notified. And I thought, you've got to be kidding. Like, there really was some people who were certain they were right, who were in complete disagreement, existed. I had never heard of it. And so that's part of my excuse that, like, if I had known, maybe I would have considered that there was something else to consider. But as far as I could tell, it was completely unanimous.
Are you one of the 12% of Americans who still approves of our government? Then we need your help to force the other 88% into compliance. When you're not busy spying on your neighbors or squinting at everyone, tell anyone who will listen why more government is a good thing. You'll get a warm and fuzzy feeling demanding more taxes and arguing in favor of gun control while militarizing our police, because folks just aren't smart enough to handle real freedom.
That is so square. Check out the additional Freedom Fiends show, Freedom Fiends Live, every Sunday on the LRN.FM streaming feed or satellite radio.
Broadcasting live and worldwide from a windowless bunker inside a mountain near an undisclosed location in the rural Wild West of the occupied states of America.
Freedom Fiends Live expands on the Fiends' weekly Wednesday podcasts, but now we're kicking the hornet's nest live. Talk back to the back talkers every Sunday from 5 to 7 p.m. East Coast time. From the makers of Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom. Freedom Fiends Live. Call in soon before we get droned. I back Ron Paul, but I'm an anarchist. I'm a non-voting anarchist who's going to vote for Ron Paul, which is hard to explain to a lot of people. Are you an anarchist and are you going to vote for Ron Paul?
I am an anarchist and I would vote for Ron Paul, but I hell, who's going to listen to this? I have and so okay. I don't think I can vote. Maybe I'll have my act together in time for what, June? Probably not. But I certainly would, And the last time I voted was for Ron in the primary last time. And he certainly is the best person ever to be a politician, and the best politician certainly in American history, maybe in the history of all parliaments ever anywhere.
Nima and I have a theory that Ron Paul at this point is secretly an anarchist who's still playing the role of a constitutionalist because he's cast himself into it over the decades. And we have a theory that when he's done with politics, he's going to come out in writing or in an interview and just say, I'm an absolute anarchist. I think that government is an initiation of aggression and don't like it. We're basing this on a couple wordings of things he's had similar to that, talking about, you know, the aggression of the state in some of the Republican debates. Do you think that's possible?
I think he is certainly a libertarian, a little L libertarian, which means that the non-aggression principle. And, you know, Ron Paul's no dummy. He's certainly, hell, he knew Murray Rothbard. They were great friends. He certainly read his Rothbard. And who could argue with that, man? I mean, hell, I don't know. He certainly is a plumb line libertarian. I think has just made, you know, a strategic decision that, which is, I think I even made a bumper sticker like this, you know, that like the U.S. Constitution, it ain't perfect, but it's a hell of a lot better than this. And I like to say, you know, if we just reinstated the Constitution as it was understood by the people who approved it at the conventions, for example, then we'd be 90% of the way to anarcho-capitalism from where we are now. So it's a hell of a good place to start. And I don't think it's just that I was echoing him all this time, but I certainly hear him say what I used to always say back when I was a constitutionalist, which is all of the most horrible things that the government does are all unconstitutional. Every bit of it. All the violations of our liberty, all the aggressive war, and all the funny money, and all the horror and pain and grief that they sow in the world, virtually all of it is unconstitutional. Not every bit of it, but pretty damn much. So let's, you know, instead of having a giant society upturning French Revolution kind of thing, let's just start with getting back to that. And then, you know, I think if Ron Paul was the president and after 8 years he had repealed almost everything and we were back to the Constitution at, you know, 1791 level of legislation or some dream come true like that, and then the rest of us wanted to go ahead and abolish the state the rest of the way, I think he would probably not stand in our way. I think he would go ahead and resign and you know, fade off into the sunset.
Do you think he's going to become president?
Oh, wouldn't that be nice? Wouldn't that just be a dream? Oh, man. You know, and the thing is about it is, I'm sorry, because I do sound like, oh, all utopian and misty-eyed and whatever over him. But the fact is that there's so much good that he could do by simply stopping some of the worst of the bad. There is just, he could just halt so much in its tracks. And just prove how it doesn't have to be this way. See, we really could have that whole, you know, liberty and justice for all like we were all trained to believe in. We can have that. We don't have to live in this ridiculous thing. And he could prove that. I mean, he could, within 4 years, sure, his first 100 days is just a lot of vetoes. And a lot of, you know, bills introduced that repeal old laws. And legalize things that should not be crimes or, you know, regulated out of existence as they are now. And as he said over and over again, his first act would be to tell the Navy to back the hell off away from Iran and tell them that we mean them no harm. You know, a de facto security guarantee at least that we're just not going to have a war with you, dude. So don't do anything stupid. We're pulling our ships back. I mean, that's how he wants to start his presidency. And you know he means it. This is not some, you know, college girls like Obama in 2008 kind of ridiculous thing based on naivete and whatever. I've read Ron Paul's speeches for decades going back. And I've watched him since 1997 and his voting record. And I've seen his speeches on C-SPAN at 3 in the morning to an empty House of Representatives. And I know that he is the real deal, and that on all of the most important things, and you hear him, he compromises. He says, you know what, I don't want to abolish all the welfare state, which I know makes y'all completely freak out, even though eventually it's got to go anyway, but I just want to abolish the empire. Let me be the president. I will bring the empire home. That's all he says every time. God dang it, man. I wish you stupid people would have voted for Ron Paul and your dumb caucus already, but you blew it. You already blew it. You know, Super Tuesday, that was it. But man, it breaks my heart. It could have been two times in a row on a silver platter. This decent gentleman hands the American people peace, liberty, a sound economy. An economy based on freedom. And they told him, beat it. Get out of my face, man. I don't care about that. I want Rick Santorum to go pick on the gays for me. I want Barack Obama to go pick on the Libyans for me.
That when you're an old man, what do you think America is going to be like when you're an old man? Are you pessimistic or optimistic, and how do you vision that it's going to turn out?
Well, I don't know. I guess it depends how many decades I have left. You know, things are going to change a lot between now and then, because it's like we were talking about with that exponential rate of improvement of computer speed and stored knowledge and storage capacity for knowledge and all those things. Like, man, there's just no way to predict. That's probably what all those futurists were saying back then. There's just no way to predict which way this is all going to go. I heard one radio show one time that some of these like real geniuses at MIT, not just some goofball, but like some guy who really thunk smart, said that they could have nanobots that start replicating, that just consume the entire planet Earth in a gray goo. That would be absolutely unstoppable. They'll be made of carbon and just...
Well, it does seem like, you know.
I have no idea, man. That's an outlying possibility. I'm not saying I believe in that or whatever.
In the play Man and Superman, there's a joke of why does the devil get all the best musicians? And I always wonder, like, why does the government get all the great technology? You know, it seems like a great technology comes out. Like, I saw one the other day. It's for genotyping. One of our fans is involved in this. He actually genotyped the entire marijuana DNA helix, which had never been done before. Wow. And it's like immediately, you know, that could be used for growing the best pot in the world that cures cancer or does this or does that. And it's like the government wants to use that to be able to prove or disprove when they're busting somebody of whether they got the pot from this guy or that guy or just some found it on the street. You know, they want to use it for evil.
Man, they are evil. To a man with a hammer, everything's a nail. To a man with a skateboard, a curb. To a man with police power, everything is a violation, an offense.
You know, the army's come out with these little robots that kind of look like dogs that can run next to a soldier and carry 80 pounds of pack, you know, up a hill of snow.
And
they're being used for war. Why can't I order one of those online at Walmart and have it run down to my house and bark and come to my door and then be the caretaker for my grandmother and protect her from violent thugs when she's out shopping? You know, why can't I get one of those?
I don't know, because there's wars for Israel to fight.
Yeah. So Ron Paul, man, talk more about Ron Paul. I like him.
Well, you know, one thing is,
We got to wrap up in about 3 minutes here, but let's talk about Ron Paul.
Well, yeah, I'll say this fast. People should read what that man wrote if they never did before. You know, take some time to really delve into his archives. He's got some really smart stuff there. A lot of fun to watch on YouTube, that kind of thing. But when I watched the Iowa caucus, and it's all too little too late anyway, I guess, but I saw on C-SPAN or one of these channels anyway, showed one of the Iowa caucus meetings. And a guy got up there, and he meant well, you know, in his pro-Ron Paul speech, but he just didn't really know what to say. He wasn't a speech-giving guy. He's just a regular guy and kind of pretty much fell short. But it occurred to me that with that crowd, that a lot of those people, they just had no idea, and they would have been absolutely blown away and their heart and their head won over if the speech that the guy had given was, did you know that Ron Paul's against welfare and always votes against it, but when he was a doctor, he gave away health care for free to the people who couldn't afford it or on a sliding scale or traded in barter or whatever. He wouldn't accept Medicare, but he always would cut people a break for his entire career in medicine. Did you know he's been married to the same wife for 53 years? Did you know that he's, again, a doctor, not a lawyer? That his voting record is XYZ, that he returns his office budget to the Treasury at the end of every year, that he refuses to participate in the congressional, very lavish congressional health care and pension things out of principle. that this man, he's not one of these politicians with the slick hair and the square jaw, man. That's not why he's there. He's actually one of us. He's actually up there. Look, he's 76 years old. He could be sitting on the front porch drinking tea. He's doing this because he's trying to help save us from ourselves, man. He's here. He's a decent guy. He's not one of these other guys. He's a decent man who somehow wiggled his way into the Congress. And just by the stars' alignment had the ability to run for president and have this national platform and this slight chance to seize control of the executive branch to just dismantle the damn thing for a change, to just roll it back, to undo that ratchet effect, if only for 4 years before it goes back to Hillary or whoever, right? Come on. And that kind of speech, I think, could have won if people had just been told, you know, what a decent guy is in a very specific way. And then also, you know, the whole campaign really should have focused on just using clips of Ron for the commercials and stuff, of using clips of Ron Paul speaking at the podium. And let him interact with the audience more. He does so good in question and answer sessions because he really means what he says. He really wants to teach. And people ask really sharp questions. And so sometimes you'll see him like rock back on his heels a little bit and go, that was a good one. Now let me see how I'm going to answer this. So he doesn't have some canned answer. He's got to really think about it and think about the best way to try to explain it in a short time. And yeah, he stumbles a little bit, but I mean, he's really good. Not, you know, Martin Luther King oratory wise, but in, you know, that non-aggression principle. He just is good on virtually everything. And so, you know, I guess I'm sad in a way, but then again, I didn't have my hopes up that he could win. I mean, the way I always looked at the thing is it's a reprise of the greatest speaking tour on behalf of liberty ever. And he's going to go down in world history forever. Like none of these hacks. He'll be remembered forever and ever as long as, you know, they don't unleash all the hydrogen bombs or whatever. He'll be the American Cicero or whatever, the guy that tried to warn you before you blew your brains out.
Worms.
Yeah.
Cool, man.
Worms, exactly.
Thanks for coming on. It's been an honor to have you, and it's been a really animated cast, and I dig it.
Cool. Well, thanks very much for having me, Michael. I sure appreciate it.
Thanks, man. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. Subscribe at kittyfeet.com. That's KittyFeet.com.
All with a rotating guest on a spit, barbecued for your pleasure.
Outtakes, yay.